Welcome to the Hannah Miller Show. And here she is, Hannah Miller.
Outspokenly conservative and unashamedly Christian. This is Hannah Miller, and this is what happened this week. So thank you guys for being so gracious regarding my impromptu week out last week. We had a great time camping. Just a phenomenal time. We didn't go far. We just went to Camp Croft, which we really enjoy. And that is such an underrated state park. If you have not been to Camp Croft in Spartanburg, you need to get your family and you need to go. It is beautiful. I wouldn't go during the summer. I've heard it's super crazy busy once school lets out, but we went in the spring right before school let out, and we went here in the fall, obviously, last week, and it's just gorgeous. There's this great, it's like a creek, river, kind of, it's bigger than your average creek, but not really deep, or, you know, really wouldn't be called termed a river either. But anyway, it's just a lot of fun, and it's quiet out there. You can do some fishing, you can do some hiking, lots of different things, just kind of fun for the family. So anyway, it's very underrated. I don't hear people talking about it a lot. If you're into the horse thing like I am, there's also horseback riding trails out there, and you can actually lodge your horse out there overnight and do some camping overnight. So it's fun. It's a fun place to go. So I encourage you to check it out because there's some really beautiful trails and things like that. But anyway, let's get to the news. Probably going to be a bit of a long episode today because there's a lot to cover because there's a lot of things that have been going on. We're going to skip around to some different places this week to cover everything. But I'm going to try to hit on these various stories and bring us all up to speed. And I will get to the Hamas, Gaza, Israel story at the end of the podcast. That's the last story for today. I will get to it, but it will be the last one, and I'm just going to hit on a couple of other things first. All right, first thing, The Hill. As of this recording, a new Speaker of the House has not been elected. Steve Scalise was originally nominated by the GOP, but he dropped out Thursday of last week, paving the way for Jim Jordan. Jordan received the GOP nomination but fell short of the necessary 217 votes after receiving only 200 votes. Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, a Democrat from New York, he's the nominee for the Democrats. He got 212 votes. No one got a simple majority in the chamber that was needed to secure victory. As of this recording, no one has received the necessary votes. In the meantime, everyone on the Hill is in a frenzy to get someone elected so they can get back to, quote, business as usual. But the rest of America is entirely unfazed by business as usual being at a standstill, since most congressional business includes, at best, undermining American prosperity and security. Politicians are trying to, this is basically a scare tactic. You know, when they start bandying about the prospect of a government shutdown, dun, 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 I mean, you can just hear them, you know, and they're trying to kind of rile people up. And in years past, this has worked. This tactic, it kind of has scared people, and then they've been able to pass basically whatever they wanted to pass, and they pass things in the middle of the night that are 1,000 pages long that nobody can read, and they get these budgets shoved out there and signed that have so much pork in them that it's just, it's insane. And they are able to get away with it because they scare people with the prospect of, you know, a government shutdown. But while that may have galvanized some folks just a few years ago, most Americans appear completely unconcerned right now. And I think it's multifaceted. I think there's just so much going on the international stage that people are distracted. I think that by and large, though, people are kind of waking up to the fact that we kind of like it when you guys aren't getting anything done. And it's better for us, for you guys, to be at a standstill. And we're not scared by a government shutdown. We want you guys to actually get something done because we're learning that every time we try to hold your feet to the fire, something scary, quote unquote, happens to distract us all. And so it's an emergency and you guys just ram through whatever you want to get, whatever you want to push through, or you totally avoid whatever we want you to do. So that's the first story. Second, New Zealand. So New Zealand has been under a left-wing government for the last 6 years, and I have a lot of appreciation. I talked about New Zealand, did a kind of an extensive podcast on New Zealand and their economy about a year and a half ago, probably. So I really have a lot of interest, I guess, just personal interest in New Zealand. And so in following them, they've had a left-leaning government for the last 6 years, but they are apparently moving in a bit of a rightward direction. And there's a lot of commentators who have been touting this and, oh, they've elected a conservative government. That's too far. the government, though, in New Zealand, those on the political right currently are more akin to moderate Democrats in the United States. So this is kind of middle-of-the-road Democrats. They're not the crazy leftists. They're not the crazy progressives. But they are. So I just kind of wanted to clarify that, because I have seen some people talking about it and talking about how conservative the new government, you know, the people elected, the new government that the people elected, and touting that and really celebrating. And while it is something to celebrate, because this is a right-leaning government, it's a move in the right direction, it's not some staunch conservative government that they've put in. It's probably what we would consider more of a moderate Democrat. Moderate Democrat political party, I guess, at this point. So, this was attributed to a couple of things. And this was last Saturday that this happened. So, preliminary results show that the National Party, which is center left, has garnered approximately 39% of the vote, with the Labour Party, which has been in charge, tallying only 27%. So that was the difference, 27% versus 39%, and 39% National Party being the party which is now taking over. Official results are expected on November 3rd. A lot of people consider the election results a repudiation of the outgoing leadership's COVID and climate policies. While the outgoing leadership labeled these policies, quote, accomplishments, and that's literally the word that they used. These policies included draconian COVID-19 policies. I mean, you guys, we all remember seeing the news. We remember seeing what was going on in New Zealand during COVID-19, which, and a lot of folks are crediting now to the serious downturn in the economy that they're seeing as a nation right now. And then the other is a new climate change policy, which will see the nation attempt to be the first in the world to tax animal emissions. And that's cow burps and flatulence. I almost couldn't believe it when I read it. I mean, I can, because, you know, we have politicians who are saying some of the same things here. But the fact that they're taxing those things and they actually started going down that road, I mean, which just tells you that it's probably likely to happen here, because they're just moving a little faster than we are. But it's just silliness. And that's all in an effort to defeat climate change. And a lot of farmers and a lot of folks in New Zealand were really feeling this taxation, and they were really feeling the hurt on the economy because of COVID-19 policies that the leadership had put in place over the last 6 years. So whether the new coalition government will undo the damage the far left leadership has done in New Zealand over the previous years is yet to be seen, of course. But as James Murphy said in his article, at least the Kiwis are headed in the right direction. And that's exactly right. And hopefully we'll see some really good things coming out of New Zealand for New Zealanders, for their sake, because obviously a lot of this stuff is very draconian and it's just crushing their economy and crushing the people and a lot of the farmers too. All right, third, Tennessee. Last month, I thought this story was very interesting. So Tennessee House Speaker Cameron Sexton and Lieutenant Governor Randy McNally, both Republicans, appointed a 10-member bipartisan, albeit heavily Republican, panel called the Joint Working Group on Federal Education Funding. According to the Tennessean, the committee, quote, will review what funding state and local governments in Tennessee receive from the federal government, how the funding is used, whether the state could provide the same services, and whether it would be feasible to reject the funds, end quote. What does all this mean? Tennessee lawmakers are considering a very bold move. foregoing federal education funding in return for regaining control of their state's public education system. This is being done and should be done for various reasons. And Michael Tennant did a great job very succinctly laying those reasons out in a recent article. First, the federal government has absolutely no constitutional authority to be involved in education. We've talked about this on the show before. I've mentioned this very first point that he makes. Second, federal funding of education transfers control of schooling from state and local governments, parents, and private institutions to Washington. Third, federal funds have been used to enforce nationwide ideological conformity, such as allowing gender-confused students to use the wrong restrooms. Tennessee House Speaker Cameron Sexton has led the charge on this. He provided his rationale by pointing out that it's not the federal government's job to provide everything for us. The Fed was set up by the states for the states. He reminded folks that, quote, we should do everything that we can to be whole and autonomous and independent from the federal government. And in my opinion, the nail in the coffin for his whole argument is this statement he made. Quote, we were doing fine in education until the 70s, which, side note, is when the U.S. Department of Education was established. So, it's not like they've increased the attainment level for us. Are you hearing what he's saying? They were doing fine in education until the 70s, then the U.S. Department of Education was established, and they have not helped the state of Tennessee with their education attainments. That's what he's saying. And really, the argument ends with the first point. It's unconstitutional for the federal government to be involved in education. But the fact that in 50 years, the U.S. Department of Education hasn't netted a significant improvement in education despite the billions spent is the icing on top of the argument cake. That's it. The whole argument begins and ends with the very first point. It's unconstitutional. That's it. That's the argument. That's all you got to say. But then you top that. Just the icing on top of it is that, okay, well, we tried it. We played ball for 50 years. We tried the thing that was unconstitutional that, you know, we already knew was not right. And it's not done anything for us. So why don't we stop this unconstitutional thing and get back to how it's supposed to be done? Of course, lots of folks are absolutely beside themselves over this, claiming that it will put undue burden on Tennessee taxpayers. And that's a legitimate question to ask and want these guys to answer. I would argue alongside Tennant that in addition to regaining control of their education system, Tennessee can probably accomplish the same things as those federal programs at a considerably lower cost. Furthermore, as the Heritage Foundation's Jonathan Butcher told The Hill, quote, a non-trivial portion of federal funding goes to administrative work necessary to comply with federal mandates. End quote. You get rid of all the federal mandates, you no longer need the funding necessary to comply. So this is all, I am fascinated by Tennessee's willingness to address this head on. Most states, most politicians they're afraid to touch this thing with a 10-foot pole. I'm just telling you. They have until January 9th to outline a plan by which they can reject either some or all federal education funds. So you can bet I'm going to be following this story, primarily because I think it's important for us to see what other states are doing and how they're going about kicking the feds out of their states. Because local is everything. If we can get the feds out of our state financially, then when they pass crazy stuff, when they're doing crazy stuff, when they're spending tax dollars on abortions or sending it overseas, it's not our dollars. And we can tell them to go pound sand when they want unconstitutional things because we have no obligation to them financially. But right now, we do because of all the money that we take from them. And a lot of it is in the form of education funding. And so Tennessee is trying to unweave that tangled web, and I'm fascinated by it. So who knows if they're going to be successful this time, but at least one state has gotten the ball rolling on addressing this unconstitutional department, and I find it fascinating. So I will try to keep you guys updated on that. All right. I tried to kind of speed through all that because I have a lot to say about Israel and Hamas and this whole situation. So There's a lot I could say about this, but I'm going to try to keep all of my commentary pretty brief. One, do not believe anything the mainstream media publishes about this. I don't think I have to explain why on this one. Two, don't believe anything the Gaza Health Ministry or Palestinian Health Ministry says. Both are proven liars. Various 2014 articles reveal this in particular with the Palestinian Health Ministry, which grossly inflated the civilian death toll in the midst of an Israeli operation in Gaza to take out terrorists. For example, they did not differentiate between civilian versus combatant and death rates. And so they just lumped them all together. And it was, you know, when there was reporting on it, because they put them all together. Because there is a distinct difference between those who, you know, a strike against a military location versus blowing up a school or a hospital or neighborhoods and that kind of thing. And so it was proven in 2014 that both of those, the Gaza Health Ministry and Palestinian Health Ministry, are proven liars in this department. And so, you know, to that I say, just don't listen to anything that comes out of there. And I would really, by and large, even coming out of Israel, because, and this is my point three, okay? Just wait. In matters of war, for the lay people, and that's you and me, there isn't much to be gained by knowing exact numbers, exact locations of events, and the perpetrator 36 seconds after an attack happens. Why? Because in matters of war, happening across the globe, the information titled breaking news is almost assuredly wrong. How many died, who killed who, where it happened, how it happened, all of those things are almost always wrong, or at least exaggerated and sensationalized when they fall under the title breaking news. Why do we halfway across the world as civilians need to know these details immediately? I'll tell you why. So we can make emotional split-second decisions. So we can quickly decide who is right or wrong. So we can send funds or weapons as fast as possible. That's why. It's also clickbait. It also brings the media outlets money because it sensationalized things. It's emotionally gripping. It draws us in. They're in the business of making money too. But a lot of it is so that you and I will pick a side and we will be emotionally engaged so that when the folks on the Hill want to send millions and billions, we're okay with it. That's why. Over and over again, the scriptures caution against snap decisions. Proverbs 14:15 says, "The simple believe anything, but the prudent give thought to their steps." Proverbs 13:16, "A wise man thinks ahead, a fool does not." Are you a fool? Are you simple? I would hope not. I don't think so. I don't think any of my listeners are. Not even having met all of you, I know that you're not. Basing major decisions off of breaking news is a bad standard of behavior. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't educate ourselves on these issues. What I'm saying is that the best information about war or any complicated international event, or really almost any event at all, domestic or foreign these days, usually does not reach us until days, weeks, sometimes months, and in some situations, years after the event took place. How many years has it, you know, we're just now finding out some information about events that have happened here in the United States. How many months did it take for the truth to really be prevalent regarding COVID-19? How many years did it take for the CDC to finally start admitting what the truth was? What about, how many years did it take us to really start finding out the truth about JF Kennedy? I mean, they just started admitting some of that stuff here in the last year. And I know that is, you know, none of us really want to hear that. It's not cool. But the truth is the truth. And with most, not all, but most events, breaking news does not affect people outside of the local region where it occurs. We live in a day and time when, you know, news travels across the world in a split second. And I was hanging out with some friends today, and one of my friends just said, you know, I'm not sure that we're supposed to know absolutely every horrible thing that happens in every place across the world. And I think that friend's right. I just think it's so much. And I think that that the global elites want you and I to be so overwhelmed and downtrodden and scared by these things that they love this information just be pumped out to you and I. All these tragedies across the world. And while they are tragedies, and it's good for us to pray and care and as the church to send aid when we can, becoming emotionally entangled and then politically entangled in these situations all across the globe and all of these situations, it really does not aid us for the most part politically. And let me explain that a little bit. For example, a school shooting that happened in, let's say, New York. Let's just say that there was a school shooting that happened in New York. Within 10 minutes of it happening, your phone is being flooded with information. How many kids were shot? Who did the shooting? How the police responded? How long it took for police to respond? And a plethora of other details. Is it necessary for you to know all of that information immediately? I mean, let's just ask myself. And I know that this is a school shooting is a very emotional example for me to bring up, and I did that on purpose. But does it change anything about your daily life in South Carolina or Montana or Texas or wherever you're living, unless it's immediately labeled a terrorist strike with the possibility that there could be other terrorist strikes? The reality is that happening, you don't have a child in the school, you most likely don't have, you know, somebody or a relative working there or any of those things. Could happen because we live in our world is different than it used to be. You know, you can travel, people travel and work in different states and things like that. So it could happen. You could have some family there, but highly unlikely. My point is that most often there are many inaccuracies circulated in the first 24 to 48 hours of a breaking news story, especially when it's an emotionally charged event. Now, it can be important for us to know about these things when it comes to formulating and voting on policies about how our local schools and police force should respond to a similar situation. Okay? So these things, knowing about it and being educated, oh, this thing happened, and let's say the police responded poorly, or the principal, they didn't have a good protocol. We need to educate and say, oh, you know what? We need to make sure that our protocol in our local school is better than that, and it's up to par, and that our police force is going to respond in different, you know, all of those things. But they're not necessarily things that you have to know or decisions that you have to make right in the moment. So it doesn't require us to consume or circulate information within the first few days of an event. We don't have to start, you know, and we've all been guilty of this, where something happens and we share a post and then the next day we find out, or 2 days later we find out that that was false information. A lot of times it's sensational information. And anytime you're sharing something and it seems sensational, it's probably not entirely accurate. Sometimes it can be, but you know, those are things that I always want to be very cautious in posting, is things that seem sensational. And so I say all of this to say that this is why finding yourself a very reliable source of information outside of the daily news is paramount, because you need a source that comes behind the breaking news and reports on the reality of what happened. And I try to do that to some degree here. If you've noticed, we're not normally breaking news, and a lot of the time it's been a week or more before we're covering something. And some of that's just the nature of the fact that we do a once a week podcast. But that design was intentional for that very purpose, is to try to give us, you know, I've just realized over the years of reporting on the news that often a comprehensive 10,000 foot view is most likely to convey the correct information versus breaking news. And so breaking news, a lot of times, should be very little detail, because a lot of times those details can change. And again, I'll put in a plug for the New American Magazine. You can read all their content for free on the internet or on their website, thenewamerican.com, or you can subscribe to their magazine. I have found them to be a very reliable, comprehensive source of information that doesn't get caught up in the clickbait stories. So I really appreciate that. All right. Okay. So now for some of the bare bones details as they stand right now. And I say that a lot for this podcast, and that's because of what I just said. As things stand right now, and I kind of keeping the details very slim, I guess, for lack of a word. Not a lot of details, because honestly, we don't really know a lot of details, and most of the details have changed since the events first happened. So Hamas attacked Israel, killing almost 1,000 Jewish civilians, including women, children, and babies. The video footage has been horrific. Israel retaliated by attacking military targets. I don't have a lot more information. I looked for more information, but it's I could not find any with numbers or to say. So at this point, Israel was accused of bombing a hospital in Gaza and killing 500 people. That story lit up the mainstream media here in the United States. This was actually, that hospital, though, was actually a hospital that my mother served in as a nurse missionary for 2 years. My father was there for 3 months when my mom was there. She was a journeyman with the International Mission Board, and my mother still have friends that were serving there or that are serving there. And so this was more personal to us as a family, because I've grown up my whole life hearing my mom tell stories about being a missionary in this hospital. It's an 80-bed hospital. It was then, and it is now, in a very, you know, poor area. And so, but as it turns out, Israel Defense Forces released audio of Hamas admitting Islamic Jihad out of Palestine was responsible for what they termed a failed rocket that actually hit the hospital parking lot. I have not heard any updated fatality numbers. I'm assuming that there were some, but it was a parking lot, not the actual hospital. It was not Israel. And there was other information, too, that revealed, you know, it could not have been a bomb or whatever the original accusation was, missile maybe, from Israel, because of how there was no shrapnel there that was from Israeli weapons, and how their weapons, basically the crater that Israeli weapons leave is different from what was seen in the parking lot. So that's where things stand right there. Now, I'm not really going to get into the America has to side with Israel because they are God's chosen people argument in today's episode, because that largely depends on your eschatology, and that is a doozy. So that's a huge. That's really a whole other podcast, yeah. So I'm not going to try to dive into that and discuss eschatology and all this kind of thing. But in rapid fire, let me raise some questions or make some comments that I think we kind of need to reflect on. And number one, if the 7 million Jews residing in Israel can't live in Israel, because that's what, you know, this whole thing is kind of about. They want Hamas, others, they want Israel and the Jews out of that land. If they can't live in Israel, where are they supposed to go? Where are these, you know, and what does Hamas suggest? And this brings me to point number two. Unlike Israel, which has allowed almost 2 million Arab Muslims to peacefully reside within Israel, Hamas has been very vocal regarding their desire to totally eradicate every Jew. See, they're not just, and this is point one and two kind of go together, because this is not just about, you know, if we're going to, we want them out and to go find somewhere else to live. No, many of these Muslims, many of those who are devout, the Islamic Jihad, they don't want just the land and for the Jews to go find somewhere else to live. No, they want to kill every Jew, man, woman, and child. They hate them. And of course, this goes back thousands of years to Abraham, Ishmael, and Isaac. And that's, you know, if you know your Bible stories, you know where what I'm talking about. And there's just been dispute between those two lines from those two brothers since Abraham. And so, but my point being, one side is peacefully, for the most part, residing and living alongside of Arab Muslims, whereas Hamas, Islamic Jihad, all of these others, they're saying, nope, we want you all dead. We're not going to just live alongside one another. And this is an example of that. Number three, why would anyone think to align themselves with a group of people who desire to enact a second Holocaust and who have raped women just this last week and afterward paraded them through the streets like exotic animals? It's disgusting. That's disgusting. Why would anyone think that that's the side that they should align themselves with? And so you really don't even have to get into just these first three points. You really don't even have to get into the whole eschatology and America has to side with Israel. And I'm not saying that we need to be putting boots on the ground or anything like that. We'll talk about that a little bit in a second. But, you know, just as far as, let's say, aligning ourselves just in our thinking, in our, okay, who's maybe, not that, you know, in matters of war, there's rarely a good guy and a bad guy. And we talked about this when we talked about Russia and Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine are two very corrupt government entities that are using their people for their own political, financial power gains. Okay? And a lot of that same thing is kind of happening here. But this is a little bit more deep-rooted and long-term here in Israel. So, number four. How did this happen to one of the most secure countries in the world? How did Hamas circumvent U.S. and Israeli intelligence agencies? Jason Whitlock wrote an article over at The Blaze. This week. And he said in his article, quote, "The last 60 years of American history has taught us to look at our in-laws before nuking the designated outlaws," end quote. And look, again, I'm not denying the atrocities that occurred in Israel, and Jason Whitlock was not either in his article. I just want us to make sure before we go, and you know, the quote that everybody, that not everybody, but a lot of politicians were using this week was, you know, I think it was Nikki Haley and others saying, "Let's finish them. All right, let's go, you know, finish Hamas, level them." Before we finish anybody, I just want to make sure that the global elites are not manipulating world events to promote endless war and conflict for their own benefit, all right? And Jason Whitlock also said this, and I think that this was a doozy. He said, "As long as the global elites keep arguing that the world is overpopulated, I believe they are capable of extreme violence to achieve their goal of depopulation. The people who promote crushing babies inside the womb wouldn't have a problem with beheading a few hundred children to ignite global conflict." End quote. And I know that people kind of cringe when you say that the global elites want depopulation and what was the other? They believe the world's overpopulated. Look, you just have to go on the WEF. It's all they talk about. Just listen to George Soros. Just listen to, my brain just went totally. Who's the other guy? Oh, anyway, you know who I'm talking about. Bill Gates. Just listen to Bill Gates and these others. They talk about this. They're out in the open about this. The recordings, the articles, the speeches, they're out there. It is not a conspiracy theory to say that the global elites believe that the world is overpopulated and their goal is depopulation. All right? And so, yeah, I think this is a little bit legitimate question. What happened with the U.S. and the Israeli intelligence that Hamas was able to circumvent them and enact so much damage? And are the global elites involved to reach their own goals of depopulation and power? Number five, why are college students across the United States siding with a terrorist organization? Not all of them, certainly not. But we have seen protest after protest pop up across the United States this week, and not only in colleges, but also in high schools, pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas groups popping up, protesting, aligning themselves with Hamas in high schools and colleges. Daniel Horowitz addressed this in an article this week, and it shed some light on it. Over the years, we have turned our universities over to foreign countries, admitting more than 1 million foreign students a year. At least 100,000 come every year from predominantly Muslim countries, including from places like Iran, with which we've been in a Cold War since 1979, as Daniel Horowitz pointed out. In the 2021-2022 academic year alone, the United States admitted close to 100,000 new students from countries that are almost exclusively Muslim, many of which are infested with terrorist organizations. We also had more than 14,000 students from Nigeria, which is about half Muslim, and nearly 200,000 from India, which is 14% Muslim. Some of these countries send thousands of students every year. Not, like I said, that's just in a year. We get new stacked on top of those the next year. Thus, in addition to the unlimited growth under the King Abdullah Scholarship Program for Saudi nationals, we've brought in tens of thousands of foreign students from Iran, Turkey, and Kuwait. And as Daniel Horowitz said, it's not hard to see how aspiring young radical Islamists could come to America on student visas and form cells of terrorists on our soil. Most certainly, and I'm quoting him here, the vast majority of them harbor sentiments that are out of sync with American values and beliefs. End quote. And see, that's the thing that we've kind of gets lost in all of this. That's the main point here, because I know we all kind of cringe when we talk about, you know, about Muslims and whether, you know, certainly not all Muslims are jihadists. Not all of them are terrorists. Obviously, we know that. Duh. But we also have to realize that some are. But the big thing is, and that's what he was just saying, the vast majority of them, whether they're terrorists or jihadists or, you know, anti-American or whether they love America, the reality is when they hold to a Muslim religion, they harbor sentiments that are out of sync with American values and beliefs. And we're importing that. And Wilfred McClay observed in an incisive 2016 essay, the explosion of foreign students has undermined, quote, the formation of young people into fully informed and fully equipped citizens of the United States, knowledgeable about their own history and institutions. And then he continued, the problem with cosmopolitanism is not with the more expansive world it opens to us, but with the more proximate world it encourages us to neglect. And right then and right there pretty much sums up this entire show about Hamas and Israel. Because when we became more global, more international in our news, information, institutions, academic institutions, when we those things became more global and international in nature because of really the internet, the problem wasn't with the expansive world that it opens to us, to use his words. The problem is that we're so caught up in what's happening in other countries that by and large does not affect us that we neglect what is local to us that really does affect our day-to-day living. And this is true on a national level here, where we're so distracted by what's happening on the federal level in Washington, D.C. on the Hill, that you and I forget what our state house is doing, what our local representatives are doing, what our school board is doing. And that, the veil on that was ripped wide open in 2020, when so many of us began to see what was actually happening in our schools and in our neighborhoods, in our police forces. These things that we've just, for years, for decades, comforted ourselves with thinking, not my school, not my police force, not in my little town. And then all of a sudden we realized that not all police officers are on our side and on the side of the Constitution. Not all educators, not all school districts would agree that a boy is a boy and a girl is a girl, or that certain pornographic reading literature should not be in front of two-year-olds. And so the cage was rattled a little bit, and we realized this very thing, is that as we've become more global in our information and international in our information, we have neglected the home. We've neglected the home. Daniel Horowitz went on to say that just as a certain number of immigrants help enrich the country, a certain number of foreign students can enhance our higher institutions of learning and swell tuition rolls. It's not a bad thing for us to have immigrants. I don't want you to think that, or for us to have, it's not a bad thing for us to have foreign students. But when major universities are composed of foreign nationals from third world countries and Islamic countries, our colleges are essentially importing those values instead of exporting our values. And that's what it comes down to when we're talking about our institutions. We're importing this anti-American value into our high schools and our college institutions instead of exporting American values and, most importantly, Christian values. According to the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy, between 1986 and 2018, Middle Eastern countries donated more than $6.6 billion to U.S. universities, many of them without proper disclosure. Qatar, which harbors Hamas, is by far the greatest foreign funder of U.S. universities. Do you know that? Most of the funding comes from the Qatar Foundation, a group with strong ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, with theologians who believe Muslims must finish the work of Adolf Hitler started. Why would we ever receive any money from, one, this organization, but two, any foreign country at all, to be completely honest? Back during COVID-19, it was revealed how much money we were receiving and how many students were coming from China and how much corruption was involved there. This is a major problem for our universities, and it's one of the primary reasons that I don't believe that the college campus and universities is a good place for young people to go. And it goes back to Daniel Horowitz's point, is those colleges are importing values that you and I as average everyday Americans don't adhere to, instead of exporting our values. And so when we send our children to these university campuses, essentially we are sending them off to, I think it was, you know, Vodi Bakum, who, of course, he was talking about the public school, but I would say it encompasses the college campus and many universities today. Certainly not every single one of them, but a lot of them, is that, you know, when you send your children off to be educated by Rome, don't, and the Romans, you know, by Caesar, that's what he says. If, when you send them off to be educated by Caesar, don't be surprised when they come home as Romans. The college campus is not, they're not American institutions by and large. Some of them still are, but most of them are not. So when they export your student after 4 years, they're most likely not going to be exporting an American-loving patriot. They're probably going to export a Marxist, which is why we're at where we're at right now. So we should not be taking in money from any of these countries. All right, number six. Sympathizing with Israel but not wanting to send money is a legitimate stance. There's a lot of folks out there. There's a lot of people my age that are pushing back against this narrative, the movement that, you know, Nikki Haley's kind of, and others of her ilk are spearheading, which is, you know, let's go in, let's support Israel, let's finish Hamas, let's do all this, you know, and really militarily and financially coming alongside of Israel. And I get it, you know, it really, we don't want to side with Hamas by any means. And, you know, what they're doing is wrong. But we also have to, you know, we're also over here saying, well, wait a minute, spending billions more to support military action in the Middle East and Ukraine, yeah, that's going to benefit the military-industrial complex. However, it's going to harm most Americans by accelerating the growth of the government's $33 trillion in debt, of debt. And one of the best ways that we can help Israel, and this is coming from an article by Ron Paul, he talked about this. He said, one of the best ways that we can help Israel and help the U.S. is by halting foreign aid, since much of the foreign aid the U.S. sends out goes to Israel's enemies. And I was looking up all of this information, and I'm just blown away again by how much money we send to over 200 countries. Did y'all know that? I mean, I don't even know the total number of countries in the world, but, you know, that's probably getting close to all of them. And just millions and billions. Millions and billions of dollars that we're sending to these countries across the globe. And just like Russia and Ukraine, and I talked about this before when we addressed that issue, the U.S. is funding both sides of the conflict. Last year, Israel received over $3 billion in financial aid, and Gaza and the West Bank received over $154 million. So Israel, 3 billion. Gaza and the West Bank, 154 million. That was last year, okay? While most was labeled for economic development, especially in Gaza, what do you think the chances are that money all went to bolstering the economy and building bridges? And even if it did, I mean, I think the chances are pretty slim, but even if it did, even if every single dollar went to building bridges and roads, maybe if we stopped building their economy and forced them to worry about it, they wouldn't have the funds to start a war. Just saying. Just saying. Number seven. Oh, so to clarify, people have a legitimate concern to say, I sympathize with what's going on in the Middle East and with Israel, but we have major issues here. And we do. And so I don't want for people to just roll their eyes at those people and immediately, you know, when somebody says, is hesitating over going to war with Israel to fight Hamas, they're not siding with Hamas. They're not over there saying, you know, having pro-Palestinian chants, okay? They're just saying, look, we got a lot of issues here. And our debt ceiling cannot handle all of this either. Number seven. Oddly enough, and I'm getting close to the end here. Actually, I think this is my last point. Yep. Oddly enough, Israel, a country literally surrounded by enemies that have for generations tried to wipe them off the face of the planet, makes it difficult for its citizens to arm themselves. For thousands of years, Jews have endured persecution and attempts at complete annihilation. The New York Times reported, quote, the United States considers handgun ownership a constitutionally protected right, while Israel considers gun permits a privilege granted by the Ministry of Public Security strictly on the basis of need, end quote. And so you've got a country surrounded by enemies, and for thousands of years, Jews having endured persecution. And then you've got this. Gun permits are a privilege. You have no right to defend yourself. According to Israel's Ministry of National Security, citizens who want personal firearms must meet several requirements, including citizenship or permanent residency, fluency in Hebrew, the minimum age, clearance from a doctor, and complete firearms training. While those requirements may seem reasonable to some people, and I agree with, oh, who was it that was writing an article about this? Paul, who is it? I have it written down here somewhere. Excuse me. Paul Dragoo. I knew it was Paul. Paul Dragoo, he said, I agree with him when he was saying that these requirements, they're actually not reasonable. I personally believe that you should just be able to pass a quick background check, and then you can own a firearm with as much ammunition as you please. Israelis, but that's only the beginning, though, for their requirements. Israelis also need to make a case for why they need a firearm. See, I think it's New York and some other states that have talked about that very thing, that you have to put a case forth on why you need a firearm. I think just by and large, the fact that you live in Israel in a country that's surrounded by enemies is probably need enough, but I digress. And once they satisfy that criterion, they must adhere to restrictions on how many firearms and how much ammunition they can own. And in most cases, the weapon allowed is a pistol with a limit of 50 bullets. 50. Furthermore, in Israel, the government grants a license only for a specific firearm, and if you want another firearm, you need another license. So with every firearm, essentially, you have to get another license. That has proven to be unquestionably idiotic, and recent events in Israel further prove that the Second Amendment should continue to be defended, and that's why I bring all of this up. Since fiscal year 2021, at least 7.5 million, at least, some suspect over 10 million, illegal immigrants have crossed into the United States, according to Customs and Border Protection. The number of illegal immigrants from the Eastern Hemisphere has more than doubled over the last year. According to the 2024 Homeland Threat Assessment, it has risen from 110,000 Eastern Hemisphere migrants in fiscal year 2022 to 228,000 so far in fiscal year 2023. So far. We're not even to the end. Furthermore, from DHS, quote, as of July, approximately 160 non-U.S. persons on the terrorist watch list attempted to enter the United States via the southern border this year, most of whom were encountered attempting to illegally enter between ports of entry. This represents an increase from the approximately 100 encounters in all of fiscal year 2022. So all of fiscal year 2022, 100 encounters. By July of fiscal year 2023, there was 160. As Paul Jurgu said in his article, quote, Americans need to face reality. The potential for Hamas-like carnage on American soil is very real. In 2020, we learned that our law enforcement departments can't always maintain order, end quote. And he continues on. I'm not one to, you know, I'm not trying to like sensationalize and frighten everybody. I know when we were out camping, people were talking about, you know, the day of jihad. I think it was Friday the 13th, or I forget what they were calling it. And people were actually texting me and saying, hey, do I need to be concerned about this? You know, what's, you know, all this kind of thing. And I don't like to jump on stuff like that, especially when information is just coming out super fast and it's hard to know what's true and that kind of thing. And I told my friends, I was like, look, it's always wise to, you know, to wear your weapon. If you have your license here in South Carolina, concealed carry permit, it's always wise to carry, especially if you're going to be in a soft target area like a school or a library, a place where you're not allowed technically to carry your weapon. Those when the places that are gun-free zones, any gun-free zone I would steer clear of that day. That's what I told folks. But I typically try to steer clear of them anyway, because I recognize them as a soft zone. And so it just was, I'm not trying to like stir up fear over all of that. What this means for you and I is it means, and this is my very last point, and I'm going to let you go. It means that we should continue to push for constitutional carry in South Carolina and make the Second Amendment so strong in our state that terrorists, domestic or foreign, will quake in their boots at even the prospect of attempting an attack in the state of South Carolina. That's my point with this story out of Israel. They decided that since the attack 2 weeks ago, they are giving out 100,000 additional weapons to those who are along the borders and in border towns and that kind of thing. 100,000 seems like a lot at first glance. You got a country of roughly 10 million people. It's just under that, 9.2 or 9.4, something like that. 100,000 on additional on the border, probably not going to be sufficient. Every Israeli that passes a background check, and then you can bet your bottom dollar that Hamas will think twice. We all know that predators always go for the soft target. Israel and the government has made their citizens a soft target. We do not want to do the same here in South Carolina. And so that's why I continue to say, push for constitutional carry. What we have now, it's better than some states, but we need constitutional carry. So that's how you and I, what you and I can do at a local level to address, that's one thing we can do to address what happened. That's a policy change that we can make to protect ourselves from what happened in Israel. In addition to every day advocating that the southern border get closed. That's really number one. Number two is constitutional carry in South Carolina. All right, hope you have a great weekend. Thanks for sticking with me on this super long show. I know that was a lot, but we just had so much to cover. Hope you have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you next time.
Thank you for listening to The Hannah Miller Show. Please remember to subscribe to this podcast. This podcast is produced by Bob Sloan Audio Productions. If you'd like to find out more about Hannah or to schedule her for a speaking event, go to her website, thehannahmillershow.com.